Okay, cool. Oh, my mom's come online. No, don't call, don't call. Oh no, this is the problem of doing it on Skype. All right, she might call at some point. Hello and welcome to the Split Screen Podcast, episode 8, or maybe 7, we're not quite sure. My name's Craig Wilson, coming to you from London Town, and where is he? One second, I've got it written down. Okay, take a roundabout to Kingston, then the A3 to Foxham Park, we go southwest on the M25, hop up through Slough, we're then going to take the M40 to Birmingham. Might want to stop here for a break, this introduction's got to be a bit long. Then we go up the west coast of Britain, up the M6, another 100 miles to the A74, on the A72, for bigger, into Edinburgh. Look for the bored Irishman who's wondering if this introduction's ever going to end. Look, he's over there, it's Alan Williamson!
You shouldn't be able to see me, I'm on the third floor, but if you do meet me and you've come all the way from London, that was a bit silly.
Yay.
But yeah, I miss you.
Thanks, I miss you too. It's a bit weird doing this in a room on my own.
It's not the same, you know, doing it in different parts of the world. I like being able to wave my hands at you and gesture to things and you know, flap my arms aimlessly if you're saying something you shouldn't be saying or whatever, you know, embarrassing personal secrets.
That's true. It's easier to communicate when you're in the same room, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that is actually, funnily enough, the topic of this podcast, because Craig's moved to London, and we did try to do a podcast in the past. Famously, Craig's computer crashed after we recorded it and broke the podcast into 1,000 pieces, like the plot of some kind of Rayman game. So this podcast is about the difficulty people have when they're communicating online. Now, I'm sure everybody is familiar with Skype, which is what we're using, or, you know, Google Chat or iChat or what have you, or even talking over the phone. But there is a big difference between, you know, talking over the phone and talking in person. The big one for me used to be, you know, with MSN Messenger.
Yep.
I don't know if that was the cool thing for people in Scotland, but I used to, when I was like 15, 16, you'd have about 5 or 6 MSN windows open and you wouldn't get anything else done.
Yeah, that was before Facebook. That's where everyone was.
That's where all the cool kids hung out. But did you find that they had difficulty understanding sarcasm?
Yeah. That's, I guess, where everyone's just started using lol and sort of little smiley faces and stuff.
Winky faces to indicate I am flirting with you.
Yee.
Yo ho.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it was hard to tell if someone's tone and being sarcastic, whether they were wondering whether the other person was going to take the lead on this part of the podcast or not.
I think the difference between 16-year-old me and almost 25-year-old me is that 16-year-old me is like, I wonder how I can make it more clear that I'm being sarcastic. Whereas 24-year-old me would think, maybe I should just stop being sarcastic. So yeah, we're going to talk about communicating online versus in person, essentially. I've had some very fun local multiplayer lately. A couple of weeks ago, I was at a friend's in Glasgow, where we played the whole way through Halo Reach on Legendary, and then we played a bit of Battlefield Bad Company 2, which I'm actually surprised I'm enjoying as much as I am. And there's a massive difference between, you know, playing online versus playing in person. I mean, we do often play, you know, as part of a squad online, and Battlefield is very much about communication. Mm-hmm. But the difference is in Halo, you know, if you see an elite coming over the cliff, you don't need to say, oh, if you look to the box and you're right, there's an elite coming around. You just point and go, there he is, he's on my screen, he's just killed me. So it's a lot more fun. And obviously, you know, people can hear everything you're saying. There's no latency issues. So whenever you slag them off or make a sarcastic comment, they can pick it up right away. Mm-hmm.
And it's easier to punch them on the side of the shoulder when they've just screwed up.
That's like, right.
If you're playing Portal and you've just opened up one under the ceiling and under your teammate, it's always easier to figure out what just went on.
That's what games are all about for me, you know. It's no fun unless you're winning, and I don't accept anything less than perfection, so that's just the way it is. If you're not gonna man up and play Portal, you'll get a portal in your feet and you'll like it. You're going into the briny deep.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, it is good fun playing in person. And I think it's more fun, you know, than obviously than playing online, but for more reasons than just because you're in the same room as your friends. I think there is, you know, there is a real breakdown in communication whenever you're playing online. I know, I mean, I've looked at sort of psychology studies during my degree where you had to like get somebody to navigate through a maze, and the way you did it was you had to sort of describe what way to go. Like, you'd like, okay, take a left, and, you know, use of landmarks and things. Now, those are really studies in language use and, you know, how people use descriptive language and how they elaborate whenever people get lost. But I guess to me, I can draw parallels between that and, you know, just pointing at something in a game, because the problem with something like Battlefield is if somebody can't see somebody coming, you can't just further your descriptions like, he's the gentleman in the camouflage, he's currently aiming a rifle into your face, and he's slowly advancing towards you with a knife in his hand. You know, you're already dead. So with games, you know, there's a more immediate need to be accurate, I guess.
Yeah, and I guess in those multiplayer games, like when you say Battlefield, I think of Left 4 Dead, where you tend to just have such awareness of the map that people have their own kind of colloquial terms. So, you know, in the funnel, like coming up to the farmhouse.
Oh,
house,
or, yes,
you know,
yes.
The sort of, yeah, he's at the barn, or you know, like in Team Fortress 2 at 2:40, you'd be like, oh, he's at the ramp room. And it's a quicker way of getting across what you need to know. And I guess those games kind of help a little bit by having a lot of sound direction in the game, where you can hear when a boomer's coming around, so you're not having to constantly elaborate and tell the whole story to, like, hey guys, I think I see something coming around it. You know,
yeah.
Because by that time, zombies are on you.
But Left 4 Dead also does the thing where the characters have their own personalities and they talk to you, and that happens in Bad Company as well. It only happens in Battlefield, kind of has two modes. There's a standard mode where you've got like a radar and you can actually see your ammo readout, and then there's hardcore mode where everything's stripped away, and hardcore's probably more fun. But in the standard mode, your friends will say things like, you know, oh, we need a medic over here, we need more ammo, there's a sniper. It's a similar thing in Left 4 Dead. You know, whenever there's a boomer, you know, Bill shouts boomer rather than you going boomer. So it's quite clever that it takes the place of you having to say all that.
Yeah.
Then you can. Then I can say things like, Craig, why didn't you kill that boomer? I'm dead now. I'm trapped in a cabinet.
But no, Left 4 Dead 2 does that. The hardcore mode as well. They call it realism mode, where they take off all the glowing outlines, and I'm pretty sure they strip down what the survivors say as well. So it does place more of the onus on you to actually communicate with your team more efficiently and to get, you know, a little bit more army about it, so that you're all,
yeah,
you know, performing your roles better.
I think.
But no, when you're saying,
that's okay. You can talk
away. When you were saying there was about the maze and navigating with your pointing, what brought to mind was if you ever saw the Crystal Maze.
Yeah.
And you would have that exact thing where you'd have the people outside watching this monitor of someone inside going through a maze, and they would always say like, go up, you know, move up, it's just up. And like, obviously, for the person who's in the maze, up doesn't make any sense at all,
yeah,
because they're going through, you know, a puzzle on the floor.
Do you think if they brought the Crystal Maze back and they had gamers and somebody said, it's just up, they would just jump and go, I haven't got it yet. I need to. Maze was great. I used to love that TV show. In fact, I wish it would come back. I think I saw somebody on Facebook kind of thing saying, bring back the Crystal Maze. But as long as they bring it back with Richard O'Brien and his harmonica playing antics.
that TV show was really like a video game when you think about it. Because there was this desert zone, there was medieval zone,
there's a future
jungle
one,
zone.
A space one.
Yeah, it was pretty much Crisis.
It's pretty much a Mario or a Sonic game. It's like But it was really good fun. And I always wanted to be in the Crystal Maze, but I was always kind of worried that if I did get on, I would let the team down, because I would just be, you know, physically inadequate. But anyway, I did end up talking about the Crystal Maze. That's not a computer game. God damn it.
Well, if you felt bad when you let them down, you'd feel even worse when you joined them, because when you're in the room, like, if you say failed when you're playing Rock Band with someone, you're all right. You want another segue to your Rock Band?
I don't need a segue. I was just gonna keep talking in an unrelated sense, like I normally do when we forget the segue. I was gonna say that it's interesting that you talked about Left 4 Dead 2's realism mode. And how it reduces the amount of things your teammates say, because it's been an ongoing problem now to try and get communication between players. To even remove that in any sense, to me, is kind of a step back. One of the things we saw in Portal 2 was that it mimics split-screen play. So if you hold down the Y button, you can see what the other player is seeing. And that's great because it firstly means that you can communicate with them and tell them where to look. But it also means there's less downtime for you, because often in Portal, you're kind of standing around waiting for somebody to do something. Another game I've been playing locally is Rock Band 3, and the main reason you want to play it in the same room is because you know everybody can take it in turns to look like a tit and laugh at each other. Rock Band, there is the communication between when to launch your overdrive at the same time. One of the cool things that Rock Band 3 introduces is they have these kind of goals for every song.
Right.
So it was something like get a streak and then pass it on, or the one that most reminded me of this is continuous overdrive. So the idea is that if I'm in the drums, I'll activate mine. As I'm about to run out, then my friend takes over and he activates his, and then my other friend comes on and activates theirs, and so it continues. And the longer you can keep that going for, the more points you get. So just a nice way to break up the rhythm action repetition.
I didn't know there was actually that much stuff in there in terms of playing together. I just assumed that you would just all have a good time and get to the end of the song. Like, I didn't realize there was that much play between the instruments, because that makes sense, because if you're actually in a band, that's the whole point. Is playing off what someone else does. So.
Well, there's quite a lot to Rock Band. There's things like if you save up your overdrive, you can save people who have dropped out. Rock Band 3 is like probably the most accessible rhythm action game I've ever seen. There's things like if you fail a song, you don't have to repeat it. You can just continue and just play for fun. And you can turn you can turn on the no fail mode at any time. My favorite feature, you can turn it on and off lefty flip at any time, because I play the drums on lefty flip, but not the guitar. Which everybody seems to find really confusing, but that's the way it is.
Right.
So it's really made an effort to make it accessible and just plain fun. So that's why it's so good. The only problem is that I don't have the funds to buy the keyboard and the pro drums and the pro guitar, or even the Squire Stratocaster that also doubles as a Rock Band guitar. So there's quite a high financial cost to get into the game. I mean, I know we've talked about Rock Band before and how you don't like it because you want people to play the real guitar, but this is a good stepping stone.
I guess so. I was thinking how people gave us crap before when we said that Rock Band was a hardcore game. But when you describe all that equipment, that's a pretty hardcore investment when you think about it.
Oh, absolutely. But then I don't want to have that discussion again. I think we've had enough. Nah. We've had enough baddie comments on the website to think about for one evening. But Left 4 Dead and Portal, they're not the first games to tackle this communication problem. And the one that springs to mind for me, because I spent a significant portion of my adult life playing it, was Phantasy Star Online for the Dreamcast. Mm. Rest in peace.
And that was like an MMO RPG type thing.
Well, technically yes, but it's more like Diablo, really.
Right.
It's not. It doesn't have the same depth as something like World of Warcraft or Final Fantasy. It's more like Diablo, as in you can customize your weapons and stuff, and it's all about teamwork, which I guess makes it a real MMO, but it's not quite as hardcore as MMO would suggest in a name. The thing that Phantasy Star did was, Dreamcast, they had different servers for Japan, the US, and Europe, and so the Dreamcast idea behind online was trying to get everybody to kind of play together, I think in a fairly benevolent way. And so what it did was, instead of you being able to type chat, which you could do anyway, you could pick a set phrase like, hi there, nice to meet you, and you would put that up on the screen. Meanwhile, your friends in Japan, and they're Japanese, because you don't know that many expatriates who are in Japan, and they get the same message already translated for them into hiragana. Or if you were in, Germany, it would translate it into German, which I thought was quite a clever idea. And they'd thought enough about, pleasant phrases and items to swap and stuff like that. And so it was a really cool idea. The other thing it did was it did little graphics. So you can make a picture and you can accompany a sound with it. So I used to have a happy noise for we just killed all the monsters, or a sad help, I'm about to die kind of noise. And those kind of things, I don't know if it's happened directly, but they've certainly been picked up by other games. So the kind of sentence translation, I'm pretty sure, is in Final Fantasy XI, which came later. Square Enix fanboys. The little pictures, I guess the things that spring to mind for me are the little spray paint tags in Counter-Strike.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, normally that's just Eric Cartman or something like that, or a man urinating against a wall or something witty like that. But it's still the idea of, I'm sure they were there to convey information, even though people have kind of used them to mark their turf. And the other things are, of course, the player emblems in Halo and Call of Duty. Although I think with the Call of Duty one, there's a real distinction between the communicative function, which is that, saying if you're in a clan or something you like, versus, a picture of two horses jousting with their penises.
Yeah, well, in Call of Duty, they're more like tattoos. And like you say, most people apparently want quite vivid animals. interaction.
I think the defining line should be, would you get that as an actual tattoo? Because my Halo 3 one used to be a cobra, and I might well get that as a tattoo. I think my new one's like a unicorn, but I probably wouldn't get two horses jousting with their penises. Probably not, or an ejaculating penis. There's another thing I probably wouldn't want as a tattoo.
And my Call of Duty tag is the split screen logo, except there's a duck's head instead of the real circular normal human head.
What are you trying to say?
I like duck salad. Actually, I was at Kew Gardens last week, and there was a family of ducks, and I watched them for about 20 minutes.
That's nice.
With friends, so it wasn't just alone.
That's okay. That's the next thing that sprang to mind was, I hope you're not terribly lonely. I try to keep in touch.
Well, a sad violin solo played.
As the world turned to monochrome, and the last crumbs of bread came out of the bag, moistened by your tears.
Another time I almost cried was when I tried to play Mario Kart Wii online, which had a similar idea.
Excellent segue.
Which had a similar idea of using preset phrases, whereas these were more specific to which map do you want to play, give me 5 minutes, I'll be back. I don't think they had one for, oh my god, what is this friend code nonsense? Why can't I just speak to you online?
Just a picture of a wrist and some razor blades, or a wee sign coming to say, need money for controllers so can play with friends offline.
Yeah, and that's part of it.
That's all of it. I just covered the whole thing. It's just a substitute for your friends. And I mean, to me, the gold standard of online racing is Project Gotham 2 for the original Xbox, which had a great community, and it got to the point where there was so much to it, and you know, everybody was really friendly and they all wished you a good game and all, and you know, they're all good fun, but there was actually quite a lot of emergent gameplay come out of it, like cat and mouse, where the idea was everybody was in like a Ferrari F50 and had to push a Mini over the line, you know. And you had a bit of a big bounce around, but you wouldn't get that with Mario Kart. You can barely get a decent race.
Yeah, no, it was pretty poor online implementation.
It's pretty poor for the entire Wii, I think. In fact, I can't really think of many games I've played online with the Wii. Really just Mario Kart. And I think with the Wii U or Wii 2, whatever, it's going to be a very similar situation. Nintendo just aren't bothered about online play.
Well, they're so worried about what content can get broadcast across their channels, and that they know that their own demographic probably skews to the very young and to other people who might not be familiar with the vile cesspit of hate that is online gaming.
Without getting onto a discussion about what happened at E3, because really all I cared about was Skyrim, you know, I don't see what the point of the Wii U is, because to me it's the opposite of what the Wii was. The Wii was all about bringing people together through computer games, whereas the Wii U is kind of, oh, you want to skulk off with your own miniature computer and do your own thing? That's fine, I'll watch TV. You know, it's like, it's completely the opposite idea, isn't it?
It's just a rebrand. It's just a refreshing all of their models so people can go out and buy it. You see what they do with DSs, you know? DSi, DS Large, DS Lite.
See, the DS Lite was good, because the DS was a good console, but the original DS is so ugly.
But it's the same thing, basically. I mean, all the games play on each of them. There's no difference. It's just a way of having something new in the store, because shops won't be wanting to stock as many Wii units, whereas everyone, they'll stock Wii U, because they know they can then do like another launch and another midnight opening. It's just another way. It's like the iPad too, you know, it's another way of bolstering their sales.
Well, the iPad 2 is different because it's a yearly refresh, and most of those phones and computers get, you know, 6 monthly to yearly refreshes, whereas consoles are in a much longer cycle. But the DS is a good example. I mean, my favourite's probably the DSi XL. It's like, well, I really want the DSi, but I was just thinking, can you make these screens a bit bigger? You know, so it doesn't really fit in my pocket anymore. Oh, brilliant, cheers. Thanks.
So strange, but wasn't the point of the DS Lite to make it smaller so that it would fit in your pocket?
Yeah, pretty much.
It's like they go one way and they sell it to people and we're like, yes, this is the revolution, and then they go the other way and it's like, oh my god, it's even better.
I still love my DS Lite. I think it's a fantastic console. Really, really good. Really, really good build quality.
Yeah.
And just, well, I like mine because it's the two-tone red and black one that I got in Japan, so it makes me feel kind of smug about myself whenever I see somebody with a plain black one, like, mine's metallic red. How do you like that? And then I go home alone.
Feed the ducks.
Then I open up the DS Lite. Instead of a game, there's a slice of bread inside, and I walk down to Hollywood Park and feed the ducks in silence.
So you said you had a question for me.
Oh yeah,
earlier.
Yeah, my question is, do you wear a headset whenever you're playing games anonymously? And what I mean is, right, whenever you're with your friends, presumably you do, because I've played online with you and we've been able to have a conversation. So I'm assuming the headset facilitated that. But say you want a quick game of, I don't know, Halo or Call of Duty, just for random people, do you put a headset on?
I do, actually, yeah. I don't tend to talk much. It really depends on what kind of game I come into. So like the two games I've played most would be Team Fortress 2 and then Call of Duty, and TF2 I play on my laptop more now. Mm-hmm. But I do put my headset on, and then I judge. I kind of, it's like dipping your toe in the bath. I see like what the chat is, and if the chat is bad, if it's, and that can be either people being like, taking it too seriously, because that's the worst. It's the worst thing is when that you get a guy who takes it too seriously, because if he's winning, then he's God's gift to gaming, and if he's losing, then it's everyone else's fault. But I've gone in there and had games where people have been quite, I would say, like minimal with what they're saying. Like, as we said earlier, you know, on Team Fortress 2, like heavy coming in the front, things like that. I'll chip in with those things, but I don't try to talk to anyone. I don't try to have a conversation. But no, I do wear the headset, but normally with the microphone muted. And then, like I say, as I figure out what the lay of the land is, I'll slowly turn down the volume on the speakers as well.
That's interesting. I never do, unless I'm playing with friends.
All right.
But then again, I tend to exclusively play games with friends. I don't have a huge amount of... I'm not really interested in the competitive aspect, you know? So for me, it's just a good way to hang out with your friends, I guess. So I'm never that bothered about it. But I remember playing like Command & Conquer and Quake 3 and things, and all you could do was type something into the chat. Now, as you can imagine, while you're typing, you're not playing the game, and therefore you're... And I remember some very profane things being said at me because I was playing Tiberian Sun with a 56k modem. And clearly somebody else was on broadband. So they didn't appreciate my lag, not one bit.
Don't you always get like the angry chat coming up between rounds when everyone's free then to get on the keyboard and clack away like...
Clack. I better get this sentence, I better get this joke out before the next round loads.
That was what happened on the... I don't know if it's on Gears of War 2, but I played more Gears 1 multiplayer, and you would get that between rounds, because during the round you could only talk and hear your own team for obvious strategy reasons, but then you would get, when the scoreboard was up at the end, you would then get the torrent of hate if you like chainsaw someone.
You suck.
But you had to be quick, because it was like 3 or 4 seconds before it would load the next round, so brevity was the winner.
I'd like to send this message to Hitman01. Oh no, I'm out of time, oh no! I'd like to address a common complaint I've heard over the course of this game. I mean, we've already talked about people trolling and flaming before. I think we covered it in our online identity episode, which may well have been episode 4.
What was episode 4?
I mean, as you said, it's like slagging off someone over the phone whenever you're on, you know, speaking to customer services. It's just the lack of face-to-face communication that facilitates that.
But yeah, people get more cocky than if they were in the store demanding to see the manager.
Yeah,
or do they? Actually, I don't know. You're in
the store. Not really, no.
Okay. My bad.
I don't want to discuss work things too much in the podcast, because that wouldn't be nice, and I'm sure people know where I work. But let's just say you get mean people of all strokes. Some of whom are not confined to the phone. Some are just mean to your face. But I'm sure that goes without saying. That happens in any job. I mean, on the bright side, the people that slag us off on our website, you know, use their full names now. So there was, of course, the guy in the Duke Nukem Post called. He was called "You Are Homo" or something like that.
Creatively spelled.
Yeah, it was pretty clever. It took me a long time to figure that out. Maybe, you know, 1 or 2 seconds. So, and I guess in brain processing terms, that is quite a long time. But I like it. I like that the veil of anonymity has kind of faded. I think I told you about TechCrunch when they introduced Facebook and you had to post under your real identity. And I like the people on the website want to use their real names and don't have to, you know, obviously if you want to go under a pseudonym, that's fine, but I quite like the people who are prepared to have a decent conversation. It's good.
Yeah, I guess it depends on what your what you've got to lose, say. So if you're someone who's prominent in the games industry and you want to go on a forum and talk about a game or rant, probably don't want to post under, you know, P. Moore
and
some tirade against whatever Sony's doing.
Yeah, like the comment in your Metacritic article from R. Pitchford saying Metacritic's a load of rubbish and only the opinions of the gamers matter, and anybody who uses Metascores to determine what games they purchase, specifically Duke Nukem Forever, is a moron.
And then he calls me a flaming jackwagon.
Flaming jackwagon. Have you actually blocked out swearing on the site then?
Well, I've got a blacklist which has got all of the curse words I could really think of. And it doesn't block the comment, it just makes it go to approval. Like, it needs to be moderated first.
Okay.
But I think, I can't remember, I think it should show up a warning. And I think that's what forced the guy to get a little bit more creative when he insulted me by calling me a flaming jack wagon.
A flaming jack wagon.
Which I loved. Like, I, if you disagree with me, but if you can be that creative, I'm okay with it. That's fine by me.
I think it's fair enough, because it's not even that offensive. I mean, you know, I've often commented on you looking like a wagon of jack, so I don't see what the problem is. Well, we talked about people communicating online, and I guess we vaguely dipped into feedback from the computer. So, you know, we're on about Left 4 Dead, and the computer giving you feedback where your friends feel not to. And that kind of thing also got us thinking about communication between the player and the computer, and then, you know, conversely, between the computer and player. And hopefully, you know, Craig, you're going to shed more light on this than me, because I seem to have just been rambling away. Your screen's frozen. Are you getting the glitchy graphic-y thing?
My cool edit has just got a spinny circle on it.
I think we're gonna have to edit this section out. Okay, so we've talked about how you communicate player to player. We've talked about how companies like Valve are doing different ways of, you know, filling in the communication gap where your friend might not necessarily want to talk. And one of the other things we've kind of been looking into, because we do a bit of research, you know, we don't like to go in blind, is looking at the communication between the player and the computer and vice versa. So instead of just, you know, you passively sending a command to the computer through the controller and interpreting it, and the computer taking feedback from you, that sort of unconscious feedback, like, you know, biofeedback, your heart rate, things like that, and then using that to augment the game experience. So it's like a kind of secondary control system. But I believe, Craig, you've done some research on ridiculous controllers that have emerged, or, well, maybe not ridiculous, but at least obscure and strange ones that, you know, have been around.
Yeah, slightly more esoteric way. So we're all comfortable with the controller gamepad, and strangely we're quite comfortable with the keyboard and mouse, which is really odd if you kind of stop and look at them and go, this is how you're going to walk and look in a game, and you go, really? I need this many buttons?
And I don't know, 52 around. Buttons seems plenty to cover the vast majority of tasks. I don't know why would you need less?
But some people have thought that you do need more ways of doing it. So the first one that I found is the Novant Falcon. Now, you looked at the image of this, and I think your reaction was, holy hell, what is that?
Right, well, here's what I'm going to do. I looked at it once, and I said to you that what I'd do is go into Google. And I'm going to lean forward so you can hear me typing in Novant Falcon. Let's hit search. And it looks like a gun stuck to a lamp.
What the Novant Falcon is a haptic device. So what you do is you put your hand through this device, and there's like a ball that you hold onto, and there's the buttons there. But it's like the ball is kind of fixed onto a robotic arm, which has motors in it. And the whole point of this is that you can sense feedback and weight. So if you're in a game like Half-Life, and it's been optimized to work with the Source Engine, so that it works in all the Half-Life games and Left 4 Dead. So if you're hitting the crowbar and, say, you kind of push it forward to hit, and you then come up against the piece of wood, it'll then give you some force feedback. So it's kind of like a more sophisticated way of doing the old rumble that you kind of get in controllers. But you can do weight, and it can simulate textures as well, apparently, so that if you're running your hand over a bumpy surface, it will gyrate and it will, you know, model that kind of, you know, to some extent. So it's trying to get a way of actual touch to your hands.
This looks bloody stupid, to be honest. It looks like one of GLaDOS's eyes offering you a golf ball as a present. The best one is the one with some kind of pistol sticking out of the Falcon. Presumably, every time you get a new gun, you'll have to get a new attachment for it, which is a great way of making money for the company.
That one's a bit out there. Also out there is the Emotive Band. Now, Emotive, they work with EEGs, which, Alan, what does that mean?
It means electroencephalogram.
Brain signals, essentially. So this is trying to be it looks like a hairband, and you put it on your head, and it's meant to detect the electric signals and impulses from your brain and be able to rework that into some sort of input for a game. Now, my old flatmate actually bought this.
What?
About
Which
two
one?
Years ago, yeah. Alistair.
I don't think you...
Possibly. Is that my going away thing? You might have been, he was only there for a wee bit. But anyway, he bought it, and
I should have mocked him for buying one of these.
And, well, I tried to get a hold of it so we could review it for the student at the time, but he'd given it away. And
he was too busy snapping it into pieces, putting it in the envelopes filled with anthrax and sending it back to the manufacturers.
Well, with this brain band, you had to calibrate it to your own, you know, power of thinking, so that, you know, for all these things, it needs to be set specifically to your impulses and your brain waves. I'm not really sure where the potential for this in a game actually lies, especially considering, you know, your brain uses 10% of its potential, and the other 90% of my brain's telling me that this thing's pretty much guaranteed to suck.
I'd just like to point out the classic rebuttal to the "we only use 10% of our brains," which is, well, if you'd like to remove the 90% you don't think you need, just, you know, fire away there.
I was really just going, using that as the setup for the joke there. But yeah.
All right. Cool. Well, I wanted to put a, you know, put a fork in it, because it's done. Because we can't say that.
We're all about honesty here.
We can't say that nonsense anymore. I don't know if you can hear me. Just pouring myself another glass of whiskey. I don't even really like whiskey. It's just that I saw you drinking a glass, and, you know, peer pressure and all that. So
I'm a trendsetter.
You are.
People see me, they want to be me. Feeding the ducks on my own.
drinking your whiskey. There's me. My bread stays in the DS. I can only drink whiskey when I see other people drinking it.
Yeah.
Oh well. So yeah, this Epoch thing. What a silly bit of rubbish.
One that isn't a bit of rubbish is the Track IR, which is a head tracking device, which again is another similar. This one looks a little bit more like a golf visor. It looks a little bit more respectable. And then there's a camera that you put on the front of your screen, which is a very small, like, webcam thing. So it's totally unintrusive.
Yeah.
But what this gives you is full head tracking in a game. So it can detach where you're aiming with your gun to then where you're looking in the game.
Okay.
And I've seen this in use with the sort of FPSs like Arma.
All
so
right.
That you can be running forward, say, but you can then look to your left and right, but keep running in that direction. Similarly, for like all the games where you're flying, it's really like a must-have, apparently, if you're doing flight sims.
Because you can look all around you while you're flying in a different direction. Mm.
Yeah, but also so that you can look at the console in front of you. And it does, you know, so if you can look left and right a little bit, and obviously you'll need to look a minor amount for it to sweep through a full arc. But if you move closer and further away from your screen, it also registers that. So the example I saw, it was in a plane cockpit, and the guy moved his head forward, and it then looked under the desk, the dashboard, okay, to more buttons. So that was
Wouldn't it be good if you could fire in one direction in an FPS and look in another? It's like, imagine if you were, you know, using suppressing fire in Battlefield or Call of Duty, and you could actually look around to see if there was other guys coming in. That'd be quite cool.
Yeah, it would get you away from that horrible sense in most games where you're a walking turret and you're spinning around with your arms in front of you.
Absolutely.
But there was a really... there was a small video that it went kind of viral, of a guy who strapped a Wiimote to his head, which was basically, okay, trying to make this as like a, you know, he's made his own rudimentary version of it. But
the
Wiimote's, cool,
the Wiimote's tracking is based in infrared anyway. That's what the sensor bar is. It's a couple of LEDs.
Yeah.
Because if you ever done the thing where, you know, people got Wii's for Christmas, and my brother got this Wii for Christmas, I was like, Mark, point it at the Christmas tree, and it went nuts because it was covered in LEDs.
Yeah, yeah. With this video, the guy, what he showed, which was quite interesting, was that if he leaned left and right, you actually saw that the depth perception in the screen adjusted to it. So it actually had more kind of realistic 3D than the whole 3D, you know, glasses when you go to the movie. Because, you know, it was based on your position when you were looking and moving.
That's really cool. So it's actually adjusting the parallax and things based on your head. Yeah, that's clever.
I wasn't
trying to nerd you out there or make it seem like I knew a lot. It was just me saying I concur with your statement.
No, it's completely
right. There's head tracking in Forza 4. So it's through Kinect, because it was a game Microsoft talked about at E3. So you basically just lean around, probably, or tilt your head about, and it lets you pan and look around the car while you're driving.
And
previously you can do that sort of using the right thumbstick. so you can look around the car, but it's always in crude 90 degree intervals, and it's always just before you hit a wall. But it means if you're, say you're in an in-car view, it means you can kind of glance to the left and look in your rear view mirror, or you can kind of glance up and look at the, you know, the mirrors. So I think that's probably a better way of doing it than using the stick, because at the end of the day, if you break down the, you know, break down that level of the player having to use the stick to track around, it does bring you into the game more. It's like, you know, about whenever you're playing a game, you're in the zone and you're not thinking about what the controls do anymore, you're just doing it. It's like, it's kind of getting to that stage where you're not even thinking about having to press a button to look at your mirror, you just look at it. I think that's really cool. That's probably one of the only interesting things I've seen Kinect capable of, because at the moment it's really just, you know, just wave your hand instead of waving a controller crosshair about, which isn't very compelling, is it?
No, especially not, because it doesn't make sense for a lot of the games, except for, you know, the dancing stuff and things like that. And Dance Central, you know, Child of Eden.
Oh, Child of Eden looks pretty lovely.
Other than that, I can't see it working in to other games in an interesting way.
I can't believe that I spent so much money on a camera this week, and then I found out, like, the day after that Child of Eden's out on Friday. I was just a crystallized tear rolled down the front of my face. It's like, no, Child of Eden, want to play you, want to get lost in your world. Apparently it's only like 90 minutes long.
Okay.
But then I'm sure at some point we'll have a discussion on how long a game needs to be to get your attention. I think we talked about it in our Portal podcast, but if it's 90 minutes as good as 90 minutes of Rez was, I'll give you my 40 quid right now. I don't care. It's going to be brilliant.
You see, like 90 minutes, that's like a movie. I have plenty of excellent movies for that length. It depends, you know, it depends whether can you replay it, because you say a game of Left 4 Dead, which we keep harping on about, and we will harp on further in our final segment.
Yes.
That kind of game can only last an hour, but you do it so many times, you know, you get hundreds of hours of play out of it.
Well, one of the things about like the Q Entertainment games, specifically Rez, but also to a lesser extent things like Luminous and I believe Child of Eden, is that they're trying to elicit an emotional reaction from you. And the idea of Rez was it would simulate synesthesia. So if you shot something, you'd hear a sound, but you'd also feel a vibration and see. It's to try and make you see sounds, you know, and feel visuals and things like that. And I guess that ties into where presumably about to talk about, which is kind of modifying your feelings based on the experience, but also modifying the experience based on your feelings.
Well, that's it. You say, you know, Child of Eden tries to elicit emotion from you, but there's no way for Child of Eden really to take advantage of that fact or to recognize it. So I remember like a year or so ago, we were in a pub somewhere and the Wii Vitality Sensor had just been announced, which hasn't actually gone anywhere. Apparently there's been issues with like predictability with it, you know, it's not very accurate. But what it was a little clip that went over your index finger and it would then measure your heart rate.
It does sound like something we'd laugh about in the pub, doesn't it?
We did, but then we kind of went on to say, well, but you could kind of use that in an interesting way if you could then measure someone's response. So, you know, measuring their heart rate is like a really easy way of trying to figure out whether someone's actually reacting to what's on the screen. Because we said before, there's a, like in Dead Space, say, or a horror game. Well, because I'm like easily scared, those games are like, I'm, you know, my heart's beating constantly when I'm playing it. So there's no like low point for me because I'm constantly on edge. Yeah. Whereas for someone who's maybe got a little bit more manliness to them, or someone who's a little bit more confidence, shall
someone
we say,
like me. Oh, Duke, you're in the podcast. Hi.
You'll be able to find the point when Duke's heart is beating kind of low and then surprise him with something new. And I found a blog of a guy on a Gamma Sutra who did exactly this, but with Halo. He's a PhD student and he had access to the sort of heart monitoring equipment.
Classic waste of university funds, eh?
Yep,
sorry,
exactly.
That's just my inner cynic, because I was never good enough to do a PhD. It's not that I don't think you guys are doing good jobs, it's just, you know.
It was like when I got a high-speed camera for my physics masters and spent the first like 2 days just flipping coins and, you know, making my friend shake his face and filming it in 10,000 frames a second. It was great.
I can't understand why universities have this funding crisis. I really can't.
But I showed you the graphs that this guy's put up, and we'll put them on the blog as well so people can find it. But showing his heart when he was showing his heart rate as he was playing through a multiplayer game of Halo. And you see, every time he initiates combat with someone, there's a very clear build-up and increase in his heart rate, and then when he dies, there's a kind of come-down as well. Yeah. But then there are certain moments in the game, like when he puts in his armor lock, it actually sustains his heart rate. So, you know, it's a way of keeping the tension at a certain level. And, you know, you look at it and you go, well, there must be ways of harnessing these very clear responses and signals, and you know, in a way which is better than a button press, which is the way you've done before.
Well, I guess something good would be, like, I think you mentioned, you know, how you were always scared playing Dead Space, and it would be something like, you know, if you're playing Dead Space and your heart rate's not elevated beyond the base level, the game could go, "Aha, I see you're not suitably freaked out," and then just have a monster randomly burst out of the wall, you know. Or or if you're playing a racing game and you know, you're not terribly excited, it could raise the tempo of the music, or it could slightly increase the speed, or, you know, that horrible rubber banding AI that used to get in, like, Burnout and things, where the computer accelerates, you could have it, you know, ease off if you're really under pressure, things like that.
Well, I was thinking, like, if you had a game like Silent Hill, where there's different types of scares, so you have some which are a bit more psychological, where a little baby ghost just walks out of a wall, and then you have
Baby ghost. how tragic, and why do I find it funny?
You know, as well as, like, the giant viscerated monsters.
Yeah.
You could say, measure the response to say, well, the guy turned out he was more freaked out by the small ghost than the giant monster, so let's have more of that in the game, if you know what I mean. Like, so you could adjust what you're doing, so it's not just a scripted series of encounters that you're going through. It could adjust maybe a little bit to your liking, to your preferences.
I like that. That's a really good idea.
So
I meant, like,
cool.
if you had somebody, say, who was really freaked out by spiders, what you could do is, you know, have more spiders because they knew they got freaked out by spiders because the heart rate raised, things like that would be really, really cool.
Or just the types of encounters, you know. Some people aren't scared by the ghoulish beast bursting out of a closet, whereas a very slow build and eerie sound might be something that, you know, it's the dread, the fear of, was it, you know, dread? That's the right word.
Yeah,
when you're building up to it, that might get them more.
Well, another thing that you could do would be, like, you could give people, I don't know, less bullets in a box and things if they weren't feeling tense, you know, not make the game more difficult, make them feel more tense. So if you could say, like, if somebody ran low on ammo or low on health, that they'd be, you know, obviously you probably would become a bit more tense.
And similarly, you could probably measure when you went too much and you threw too much at them, and, you know, they either responded, I don't know, you know, if you could track if they responded negatively to it, you could then lessen it and bring it back.
We shouldn't be giving this information away for free. You know, we should be getting paid to come up with these great game ideas. Somebody's going to come and take this and put it in Dead Space 3, and then we'll just be there like, oh, thanks for nothing.
I think this is an example where ideas are cheap, and to implement this will probably be a 6-year, multi-million dollar investment. But, you know,
as I always say on the podcast, if anybody wants to hire us to come up with these ideas on a full-time basis, you're more than welcome.
They can hire you, man. I've got my job. I'm happy.
we'll see how long it is before you're turned.
Well, we're looking at different ways that games can respond. Traditionally, you've got the old trip wire, where once you advance upon a certain position in the game space, then the next thing will unfurl.
Yeah,
it would
trigger the next monster or the next cutscene or whatever.
Yeah, so, like, Call of Duty does this a lot, and Halo Reach, which I've only just started playing, there's a part where you kind of go, you come across this abandoned house, and you're looking around it, and the dialogue suggests that there's someone creeping around, but I never actually saw them. But I obviously walked to some staircase which is too far ahead, and then all hell broke loose, and everyone jumped out of their hidey holes.
How far have you gotten, Halo Reach?
About, like, 5 minutes after that point.
Ah, okay.
I barely played it yet.
The start of it's not really indicative of the rest of the game. Most of it's not scripted. I mean, generally, you know, you get to a point, obviously, where monsters come out and things happen, but a lot of what I like about Halo is that it's a lot more freeform than Call of Duty. It's not just, you know, one caravan and 200 guys rushing out of it until you advance to the next part of the caravan park.
So going through this house, had they had in place this sort of heart rate monitoring, or even if they had eye tracking, they would have known for sure when I actually saw the beastie that was hidden around the corner, and then they could have pulled the trigger rather than trying to guess, like, well, by the time he's gotten to the stairs, he's probably seen it.
It's like, if he's walked this far and hasn't noticed it, he's obviously a dumb American redneck that doesn't care about the story, so we better just chuck out some Covenant for him to blow away, or he's going to get bored.
And if you remember in Portal 2, we said there's the moments where Wheatley is peeking around the corner.
Yes.
Or in Half-Life Episode 2, there's a part where the hunters are kind of, when you first introduced to them and they first attacked Alex, that's one of those moments where the level is filtered and funneled in a way that you can really only be looking in a certain direction.
Yeah.
But again, if they had eye tracking, they would be able to know for sure that you were looking at this area of the map.
Oh, if
area
they had
the
eye tracking. Do you know I've been eye tracked?
Have you?
Yeah, that we, well, after I graduated, this is a sad story. After I graduated from university, I did not have a job. And I applied to a lot of jobs. One of them got back to me. That's where I work. But I started doing psychology experiments for money. And a lot of them were these eye tracking studies. And one thing about eye tracking is that it needs to be precise. It's not just, you know, you sitting in front of a camera. You need to actually calibrate the cameras to your eyes. And they frequently go out of sync. So eye tracking is a good idea, but it's also probably quite impractical. And it has to be within a specified lab environment. I mean, whenever I was being eye tracked, there was a camera into each of my eyeballs and a giant helmet on top, you know? It's not like Kinect's right. Going to have that kind of thing. Now, eye tracking story two is that apparently they got this eye tracking camera and mounted it to a guy's head, and they recorded him to see what he was looking at all day long. And apparently his eyes went were very, very funny.
Was there a female scientists involved?
You know, I don't know, but I think when he was out and about, there were probably two things that sprung to mind on many occasions. Was that too subtle, do you think?
Because like we've not mentioned that at all, but that's completely where all of this technology will end up at some point.
So you're saying, like, if you're playing Dead or Alive, it'll look at how often you're looking at the breasts, and we'll make them bigger or smaller accordingly. So if you just want to get on with the game, it'll shrink the size of the character's breasts to normal proportions.
It'll measure blood flow and things like that.
Unable to get a heart rating. It seems you're losing blood. No, it's just being redistributed.
One company who've been measuring blood flow is our favourite company who we love to talk about. And
one company
Valve.
That really gets our blood flowing is Valve.
And the reason they get our blood flowing is because they put out a lot of presentations and publications and articles, so it's easy to see what they're looking at. And they've been on this whole kick of biofeedback, and they've looked at heart rate, as we've said, and they've also looked at skin conductions and facial expression, the eye movement stuff. On the eye movement front, I'll put up a video into the podcast as well of a scene from There Will Be Blood, which shows a focus group who were eye-tracked, or whose eye-tracking was tracked. Whose eye movements was tracked, and then
whose
placed onto the
movement
screen.
Were tracked. There we go. Yes. Whose eye movements were tracked. That sounds better.
And then overlaid onto the screen. It's just really interesting seeing you get a better idea of how people direct. You imagine it would feed back into directing a scene in a more polished way. But the two most interesting parts were heart rate and the eye tracking. And if you think in terms of Left 4 Dead 2. And the AI director, one of their other presentations, it chronicles how they try and guess or measure how you, the survivor, are doing in this world of zombies. And they take into account your health, how much ammo you've got left, where you're looking in the general direction of your character. Obviously, they can't tell whether you're looking in the foreground or the background,
yeah.
Or whether you're looking at the information on your screen. But they take into all those things into account. And how recent have you been? Has it been since there's been a horde rush? And they try to get a sort of intensity measure, and then that's when they decide whether or not to throw something at you or whether to let you be. Obviously, if you had all these independent measures going in, they would know for sure. And one of the little applications they had for the eye tracking was just for reading your partner's health.
Okay.
So instead of there being the health on the screen displaying for all your three companions, it would only be if you physically looked at Nick, would you be able to tell whether Nick was okay and needed healed or not?
That's interesting. That's a whole new twist to it.
I think they looked at whether or not... they did the heart rate testing again, which just produced another graph that showed very clearly when the tank music hit, you know, everyone spiked and
everyone
basically
goes,
crapped.
Not again.
And everyone crapped themselves. So that in a game where it naturally is trying to be dynamic, it's probably going to have more results than a game where it's more by the book. If you think like I don't want to say Call of Duty all the time, but it's the one that comes to mind, or even, you know,
it's just our slang term for mediocre, isn't it?
Oh, not even mediocre, but it is you can imagine having the game designer sit down and write down exactly what they want the player to do in what order so that they can have the optimal, you know, performance for how they've set up. Because that's how I always, actually, I feel like so many of these games are. They're kind of like a theater production where we're like the main actor. We're like the main character, but we're walking in off the street. And the way they do it with the sets and all the other characters, they position it so that we can only follow the script that they've got set. Like, whereas if like games like Left 4 Dead and, you know, even like sports games, actually, they're able to have a little bit more improv and dynamic and adjust to what we do. So if we, you know,
well, the reason why modern games are made like that is because it's less work for them to do. Like, if you're playing Call of Duty and you can say exactly where the player's going to go, right? You know where they're not going to go, and therefore you don't need to make those bits of the game. So something like Battlefield Bad Company 2, whenever you're in the single player and you go the wrong direction, like you step over the wrong bit of grass, it just says, you are leaving the battlefield, turn back. Whereas in something like GTA 4, you can't do that. You have to let them go wherever they can go. And that's why, but, you know, Vice City just had, if you fall into a pond, you died, because it meant they didn't have to code all that stuff. Whereas in GTA 4, because you can swim, then they have to take it a bit further and have, like, I don't know, sharks in the water.
I mean, you say that, that's true that they have to render more of the world, but even in Grand Theft Auto 4, they actually, in the, whenever you're chasing someone in a vehicle, they pull you back into that very scripted sequence, and they don't allow for that. I don't know if it necessarily be easier to do that. It seems to be more work, because you need to have someone to do all the heavy scripting. I'm sure they're both horrifically difficult for each.
I think
each
it's
of
like
merits,
the unpredictability of not having the scripting means that you have a lot more bugs that could potentially occur, and you have a lot more scenarios that could happen.
Yeah, that's it. You've got a lot more dead end case scenarios that can come up. But hey, you know, in terms of responding to the player, those kind of games lend themselves more to it because they're more flexible in their structure anyway.
Yeah, well, something like GTA would be great, where if, you know, it's so your heart rate was fading during a chase, I could just have a helicopter or a SWAT van roll out of nowhere, you know? That kind of thing would be quite fun.
My final kind of thought on the eye tracking was I'd read that, or I'd been told by a friend that in L.A. Noire, there's certain parts where you're examining clues. So there's certain parts where you'll get a pink slip and you'll be looking at it on the screen and you'll realize that the name of the guy is actually the name of, the suspect's brother or whatever. But and I asked, like, well, how does the game know that you've seen that bit of information? And the way it works, it's kind of like in the video game Lost, if anyone else had the misfortune of playing.
We both played it. It was rubbish.
Where essentially you have the pink slip in your hand and you kind of move it up and down the screen, and it's once you get to this optimal position, then that triggers the aha moment. Or say there's a speck of blood on the end of a knife, and then you look to that bloodied handle, it would then register, like, oh, he's noticed the clue, and it would then go on. Although I guess that was kind of like pixel hunting without a button input.
Well, imagine if you were playing Monkey Island and you just mounted yourself to, like, I don't know, a wheelie chair and skimmed up and down the screen while the eye tracking did the work and all the objects you needed were highlighted in gold. That would be a bit, I guess that is like waving the mouse about for the 21st century, because that's what the mouse is about, isn't it? It's the mark where your eyes are drawn to. It's like whenever you're using a photo editing program and you've got like a loop tool, or if you're trying to, you know, zoom in and text on the iPhone, it magnifies it, because that's what your mouse pointer is doing. It's augmenting the role of the hand.
Yeah, it's all about trying to figure out whether or not your audience is paying attention or not.
Well, I guess one potential use for biofeedback would be for us to find out where it all went horribly wrong. Whenever the eye trackers failed as people's eyelids closed and they drifted off to sleep. Whenever the heart rate slugged to a comatose state. Yeah. when it was unsure whether our listeners were alive or dead. So on that note, we'll call an end to this. And we'll see you next time. As always, please leave us a review on iTunes. Spam it to your friends on Twitter and Facebook. We like that too. Send us an email. Go to the website. We won't bite. Apart from that, we'll see you soon. Thanks for listening.
Bye bye. Okay. Yeah, I think so. My God, I can't believe that, like, stopped so many times.